It's pretty hot over here in Tiburon, and the air conditioner in the room doesn't work too well. So everybody's hot. But some of you online are far away and have never been here. And I will tell you that it's really beautiful up here. This church that we have been practicing at is on a hill. It's called Rock Hill because there's a giant rock outside the church. It's about 8 or 9 feet tall, right? It's a huge rock. And here in the back of the church, where we have the seminar room, it has a big view of the bay. You can see the bay and the Golden Gate Bridge, and you can see the tower right near where Denise is in San Francisco from up here. And when the sun is shining, it's really beautiful up here. So it's a great day. And I hope everybody will have a chance to come here someday. I think one time Ron and Fern came here. I think they're in Massachusetts. Yeah. And they were like, they thought they were coming to like Disneyland or, you know, the Vatican or something. It was, whoa, look at this place. Wow. Yes. Anyway, it's really nice here. So I hope you'll all get a chance to be here one day. Okay, well, we're continuing. You know, we're only spending 3 weeks on this book, Seeing One Thing Through, and that's certainly not because it's only worth 3 weeks. It's worth 33 weeks, and we'll come back to it. But because of the schedule, we only had the 3 weeks for now. So we'll go on with a little bit more from it. I'm going to read on page 169. Why do you practice? Sometimes I am asked, why do you practice? There are many possible responses. In the old days in China, the question was, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? This became a well-known koan that appears often in the koan collections, and there is a variety of seemingly puzzling responses. Sir Edmund Hillary's response to why do you want to climb the mountain was because it is there. This is a little nugget one can keep unloading for a long time. When Dogen returned from China, he was asked what he brought back to Japan. He said that all he had learned was that his eyes were horizontal and his nose was vertical. When I sat down the first time for Zazen, I knew I was home. I was like the prodigal son in the Lotus Sutra who had stumbled into the doorway of his father's house. This is not an uncommon experience for a Zen student. I had found Zazen and a teacher whose practice was patience and sincerity. He said that those who have the most difficult time and who persevere no matter what obstacles they meet in the way, in the end, usually become very good teachers. Someone asked me what my teacher was like. Well, he was very gentle and kind, and at the same time, very firm and strict. During Zazen, he would say, "Don't move." Once he said, "Don't chicken out." We liked it when he used our colloquialisms. We had to come face to face with our difficulties and through our own effort find the way through. And there was no escape. This is an example of his compassion and strictness. He knew how to push us and how to ease off, when to hold firmly and when to let loose. He never stopped encouraging us and never gave up on anyone. He never made a judgment as to who was the best horse and who was the worst. For him, the worst horse in the long run might actually be the best horse, or was already. Sometimes the one who is having the hardest time and practicing wholeheartedly and unselfconsciously is actually stimulating the practice without knowing it. In my early years of practice, I had a very hard time. I feel that I have experienced most of the difficulties that everyone does. The pain, the frustration, sitting through emotional problems, mental stress, and so on. I was never suspicious of the practice. Instead, I looked at my own shortcomings as practice opportunities. When we can offer ourselves to practice wholeheartedly, together with all our defilements, the Dharma can do its work of transformation. Why wait? I think I practice for the sake of practice. As a longtime gardener, I love to make compost, wonderful loamy soil. As a byproduct, wonderful plants come from the soil. As a Zen student, I like to encourage others. In Soto Zen, a teacher is like a farmer, carefully raising his or her crops. Through steady, constant practice, we cultivate the ground, maturing the wonderful variety of flowers, and enjoy helping them to mature and bloom, each one singular and beautiful. People sometimes ask if offering so much Dokusan, one-on-one student-teacher discussion, is tiring or exhausting. Actually, I thrive on encouraging others, so Dokusan is actually energizing. When I give a talk, I mostly want to encourage people. This is the practice of Jijuyu Zamai, the joy of fulfillment in our offering to everyone. When we give in this way, unselfishly and without a motive, we are one with the ring of the way, the circle of the way. I often think a Zen student is like that ice plant on a cliff facing the ocean. The winds blow, the sun beats down, the ocean mists and storms, and the ice plant simply weathers it all. What a life! My old teacher once said to me with a smile when I was having a really difficult time, "If you can find something more difficult, you should do it." Such compassionate encouragement has kept me on track for a long time, all the way to the end. And then another short section, lighting up our own corner of the world, that appears on page 276. Sounds like the wake-up bell, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it sounds like that.
Yeah.
But it's not working.
There's a bell outside. I don't know what it is, but...
Oh, they're doing some work over there.
Maybe, yeah, somebody's working. Anyway, it sounds like the wake-up bell during Sesshin. We are so fortunate as human beings to be living here in Berkeley, California in the year 2012. California is the cornucopia of the world, and Berkeley is an oasis for progressives. The spirit of tolerance and liberality here allows us more or less unrestricted freedom to explore creative solutions to universal problems unhampered by religious or political bigotry. As we go about our normal daily activities in our relatively safe environment, we are haunted by the enormous suffering that is being inflicted on ordinary people all over the world. When we open ourselves, we can easily be overwhelmed. In order to have some mental and emotional freedom to pursue our activities, we often set up a barrier or compartmentalization in order to have some objectivity and go about our business. Allowing ourselves to focus on the atrocities, inequalities, manipulations, deceptions, power struggles, criminal corporate control, and unemployment problems of our own country, let alone the rest of the world. And this is 2012. You ain't seen nothing yet. Day after day leaves us with a frustrated and seemingly insurmountable feeling of helplessness. These problems have been with us since the beginning of time. And now, because the world is becoming a smaller place, we no longer have the luxury of only dealing with our local problems. So the question is how, in the face of these overwhelming disasters that will always be with us, can we do something positive and not be drowned by so much negativity? We can work for change by voting and adding our names to petitions for change and supporting organizations for justice and so forth. But most importantly, how, in the face of this endless process of fighting or putting out one fire only to have a new one flare up, can we maintain an attitude of equanimity and optimism supported by wisdom and compassion? Suzuki Roshi once described our practice as lighting up our own corner of the world. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, although there are no sentient beings to be saved, we must save them all. What does it mean to light up our own corner of the world as well as saving all beings? As self-creating humans, we have the capacity to influence our own house, our own environment and surroundings. Each one of us has a sphere of influence. When we do zazen in the morning, prajna arises in the world. Radiant light arises and manifests in the world. And our activity proceeds from zazen and is sustained as compassionate action. The influence of our practice can have a positive, far-reaching effect in the world. We can practice for the benefit of all beings without being attached to impossible results. This is shikantaza, just doing. It is genjo koan, the koan of our daily life, moment by moment, as it proceeds from zazen. True joy runs deep like the bottom of a river and does not depend on good and bad circumstances. It supports us through all of our suffering and manifests through all our sincere, continuous practice. When we can forget ourself and support those around us, the way of harmony appears unhindered. Strong confidence comes little by little through small successes. Wonderful. Well, I'm always encouraged when I read inspiring teaching like this. And it reminds me of how great our practice is, because it's so simple and it's so noble. When we can forget ourselves and support those around us, the way of harmony appears unhindered. So although really the only thing we're doing is paying attention to our own practice, paying attention to our body, our breath, and our conduct, really the whole point is to influence the whole world, to support others and be a source of harmony and peacefulness in this world that really needs that. And as he says, it just happens unhindered as we continue to practice. So that's classical Zen, and it's wonderful. But it's probably because of that view that we hardly ever talk about the craft of actual human relationships. For that, we have the precepts. And when you think about the precepts, really, they come down to just to being kind and supportive of others, not hurting anyone, but encouraging everyone. But in classical Zen, you usually don't hear much talk about the precepts. The emphasis is on the absolute side of the precepts. The relative side, we don't emphasize. And in some systems of koan study with curricula, the precepts are taken as the ultimate koans. They come at the end of the whole curriculum, which means that they're understood as being beyond ordinary discourse. And maybe you notice, we brought up at least once, maybe more than once, in Becoming Yourself, Suzuki Roshi's talks about precepts. And mostly Suzuki Roshi is emphasizing the broad spirit of precepts. He's not talking that much about specifics and details of how we behave with one another. And as Mel says somewhere else in his book, the Japanese way is just to observe and imitate, not to explain with talking. And that's the way a lot of us old timers, like me, were trained at the Zen Center. And we took the precepts and we never even knew what they were, you know. We talked about them, we hardly even knew what they were, you know. But those days are gone, and these days we talk a lot about the precepts. We have classes and discussions, and we're always trying to understand through those discussions and reflections how to live this life with other people in a complicated world, how to be compassionate and caring. And this is unusual for classical Zen. I don't know anymore. I used to know what was going on in different Zen centers around the country. I have no idea now, but I would be surprised if in other centers they don't also do the same thing. Discuss the precepts and take them seriously as guidelines for conduct. Decades ago, I noticed that the problems we were having in the community, not everyday Zen, but at Zen Center, a long time ago, I noticed that the problems we were having came from this very point, that we emphasized Zazen and individual practice, but we lacked the context of Mahayana Buddhism that all the old teachers, including Dogen, would have taken for granted. So we needed some remedial work. And that's one of the reasons why, from the beginning at Everyday Zen, we practiced small group discussions, which is never done in Japanese Zen, never. And it was never done at the San Francisco Zen Center either. Maybe it is now, but it was never done there. Small group discussion gives people a chance to express their understanding to one another rather than just expressing it to the teacher in Dokusan. And that way, we build community through intimate dialogue, and we learn the Dharma from each other. We're not just paying attention to our own practice, we're sharing our practice with one another and learning from each other. So we started doing this the first meeting we ever had in Everyday Zen, and we've been doing it for 26 years, and we do it at every Dharma seminar and every all-day sit. And we also began to take up some Mahayana teachings that do talk directly about human relationships. Of course, in Mahayana Buddhism and in Zen, the first point about relationship with others is there are no others. Self is others. You are the others. They are you. And so to realize that, to appreciate that point, is the beginning. That's really, really important. In Mahayana Buddhism, compassion is not altruism and self-sacrifice. It's just the truth of how things are. So that's the basis, the absolute side. And it's important that we don't forget this and emphasize this, because in human relations, it's so easy to forget this and get tangled up with one another, even as we're trying not to get tangled up. On the other hand, there are others, and we need them if we're going to learn how to love and be loved. So the relative side is equally important, and as we know, our tradition is constantly harping on the point that there is no relative side and there is no absolute side. There's only one side living this life. But it's good to think about the relative side. So one of the texts, we've several things that we have studied a lot over the years. We've studied a lot Shantideva's famous text, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. We study the six paramitas. I wrote a book about the six paramitas. We've studied the Lojong slogans. I wrote a book about the Lojong slogans for that reason. Relating to other people, compassion, love, kindness, respect is really, really important. And we learn the basis for this on our cushions, but I think we need more teachings about it. So, with all that in mind, I wanted to bring up like a chaser, you know, to what we just heard from Mel. Two practices that have been on my mind that have to do with cultivating a happy and positive relationship to others. The two practices I want to talk about just a little bit are upeksha, or equanimity, and mudita, or sympathetic joy. And you know these. These are two of the four immeasurables, the four Brahma viharas, or Brahma abodes. The other two are compassion and loving kindness. But today, I'm just going to bring up these two. And I'm bringing up upeksha in a specific context of being with others. So in this case, it means always being even-minded and patient and compassionate with others, even when they're difficult, not being reactive, not flying off the handle. So in this sense, upeksha is pretty much the same thing as kshanti paramita, the perfection of patient forbearance. And mudita is feeling happy when other people are happy, sharing in their happiness rather than just noticing it, and maybe even being slightly jealous of it or resentful of it, as happens once in a while. So how do you practice these two? Well, there's lots. Shantideva has something like 157 verses on the practice of Kshanti Paramita, but just to say a little, just so that you think about it. Maybe the first point is to note that Mahayana Buddhism is really rather radical in its call for compassion and love. I mean, everybody likes compassion and love. It's very popular, compassion and love. I have no doubt you can find some people who don't like compassion and love, who would consider them to be, you know, fake or weak. They would have the theory that people are basically, fundamentally, you know, evolutionarily disposed to be ruthless, and that everybody really wants to smash everybody else. So why don't we just admit this and behave accordingly? Forget about compassion and love. It's just phony. But I think there are not that many people who really look at it like that. Mostly, in general, the average person, I think, would agree that yes, it's probably true, there's lots of fear and aggression, certainly in other people, maybe even possibly in ourselves. But all in all, it would be better, wouldn't it, to prefer to moderate that rather than emphasize it and try to get over it rather than lead with that foot. I think most people would agree with that. So in a way, there's nothing radical about compassion. It's kind of practical in a way because, you know, it's better to have good human relations rather than to feel like every time you meet somebody, you know, you're in a contest with them or something, which sounds, you know, really exhausting, and who wants to live like that? So yeah, it's just practical. Compassion, love is just practical. But in Mahayana Buddhism, as I sort of alluded to earlier, it's a much more radical proposition. Because, like I said, there are no others. The self you identify as you is totally, totally, and painfully fake. So in order to be really happy, Mahayana Buddhism holds, the only way is to throw that self away completely and utterly, and to favor others, love others, obey others, yield to others, and see yourself as the others. Well, to most people, that sounds like a couple of bridges too far. Okay, I want to be compassionate, but wait, you know, that's, I don't know about that. I don't know whether I can see it that way. But this is really what Mahayana Buddhism holds. And when you practice this understanding and these teachings over time, you see that it is very reasonable and practical. The bodhisattva is the one who is totally loving and compassionate in all circumstances, bar none. Okay, so now somebody insults you, steals your money, hits you on the head for no reason, or something like that. Or maybe they're not doing this to you, they're doing it to someone you hold dear, someone you're defending. And the impulse rises up really strong to get angry and immediately to seek justice, which usually means revenge, punishment. The bodhisattva would never do that. The bodhisattva would understand that the person who has done this is putting themselves in great peril, because to harm another person erodes integrity and well-being. In other words, the harm to you or those you defend is minor compared to the harm to the perpetrator themselves. So the bodhisattva's concern is just as much for that person as for the victim. And when you are committed to practicing that way, you realize further that by insulting or robbing or smacking you on the head, the person has given you the chance to practice Kshanti Paramita, which is very valuable to you and gives you the possibility, supported by your Zazen practice, to look within yourself, to study your own reactions and the suffering that those reactions bring to you, your own reactions bring to you. And to be able to see really clearly, as you wouldn't otherwise perhaps, how bad and how painful and how harmful those reactions are. So that's why Zazen really helps, because when you do Zazen regularly, you have the ability to see this and not be compelled to act on it, but let it be in your mind and let it flow out of your mind. So in this sense, Zazen has two really powerful effects. First, continued Zazen practice helps you see the absolute identity of self and other. You come to realize that. And second, it gives you more space inside so you can be with and study your own reactive mind. And you can get really good at this. And you can do it spontaneously, or more or less spontaneously. And then you can be confident in all your human relationships, knowing that you really don't have anything to fear, because you will be okay. And so you can meet any person, no matter who it is you meet, with kindness, because they can't hurt you. They can insult you. They can rob you. They can hit you on the head. They can maybe even kill you. But they can't hurt you. So by insulting or attacking you, the person has actually given you a great gift, the gift of becoming a truly patient and wise person. And that's the course of practicing the precept not to harbor ill will. So mudita is the other side of the coin. With kshanti, we are practicing with others' woundedness and unhappiness, with all the things that have twisted people up and made them difficult people. We're practicing with that side of people. In the case of mudita, we're practicing with the other side of people. We're practicing with people who, at least in the moment, are happy and not hurting us or giving us a hard time because they're happy. And in both cases, the idea is that we would extend ourselves, we would go beyond ourselves, we would get over ourselves. If you are honest about it, and I recommend that we all look closely at this question, you notice that when other people are happy, you don't necessarily celebrate that, unless it's your granddaughter. Then automatically, you know, you celebrate it. But if it's not them, if it's somebody else, you know, you don't necessarily be so happy that someone else is happy. Maybe you don't really notice it that much. Or maybe if you do notice it, you might be a little cynical, possibly slightly jealous. In any case, for sure, it has nothing to do with you. It's their happiness, good for them, you know. And maybe seeing other people's happiness is slightly annoying. Because look at them, they're smiling, they're really happy, and in this particular moment, you're not that happy. You hadn't noticed that you weren't that happy until you saw them being so happy. Now you notice that you're not really that happy or satisfied now or in general. And so their happiness kind of rubs your own unhappiness in your face. So maybe you're not that thrilled about it. So mudita is an intentional practice that turns this whole thing upside down. When you see another person being happy, you take that happiness as your own. Since you are getting the point that the wall that separates them from you isn't really there to begin with. In fact, their happiness is not really their happiness. It's not stuck over on their side of the wall. It is happiness that arises among us all in this moment. It's everywhere. And it's just as much in you as it is in them. So you train your mind to find joy for yourself wherever there is joy, even if it's not joy that arises from causes and conditions in your life. You can even have the practice of walking down the street and keeping your eye out for some youthful, happy person walking by in full health and, you know, top of the world. And you can be happy. Because they're happy. After all, why limit your happiness to only one person's happiness in special moments like your birthday or when you're on vacation in Italy or something, when you can have tremendous amounts of happiness all the time, every single day, when you practice mudita? So these are practices that the ancients, Buddhist sages, have thought about and recommended to us and given us many instructions for. And we can take them up and cultivate them. And the more you do them, the more you are extending the spirit of Zazen into your human relations. And the more you do that, the more the world is changing for you. And the more you realize and really feel honestly in your heart and mind that, like the sutra says, like we studied so much this last practice period, everything actually is Buddha. And the world really is a Buddha field of practice and realization. As we heard from Mel, we don't ignore, we cannot possibly ignore the suffering of the world, just as we cannot ignore our own suffering. But we can find a way to live with it expansively, honestly, and beautifully. And we can face it completely with these kinds of practices without being eaten up by it. The great thing about Dogen's way of Zen and about Dogen's understanding of Zazen is that it is, as I said a minute ago, a very important background for these practices. To do these practices without the background, which is in our whole body and mind, of Zazen, is much more difficult. It's the compost, the soil. Zazen is the compost, the soil, as Mel taught us. And when we cultivate that, it will prevent us from perverting these practices, because they could be perverted. They could be messed up. It seems like, how could you mess them up? But you can mess them up. To have a dutiful and overly literal conception of kshanti or upeksha or mudita, and then to go about dutifully and maybe somewhat aggressively practicing them, imposing them on yourself, could quickly become pious and limiting. You could end up censoring your impulses and becoming a very false, stiff person, constantly afraid of messing up, so careful of every word and gesture that you're stressed out by the slightest thing. It would be very easy to practice being virtuous in that way. I think Zazen makes this much more difficult. It protects us from this kind of practice. The Zen spirit allows us to practice kshanti and mudita without ever denying or being afraid of our own human impulses, and without ever forgetting the wide and magnanimous spirit that underlies these practices. Anyway, when I was reading Mel's, I thought, well, maybe we need a chaser. Maybe it'd be good to bring up something like this, which is also part of our practice. So that's what I wanted to say. Before we go into groups, while everybody online is still here, we are in a very exciting period of time. There's so many things going on. I'm not even thinking about the NBA finals. Never mind that. But there's all kinds of great things going on. For one thing, we're sitting this Saturday at Green Gulch. Who knows how many times we can do this together, right? So this Saturday, everybody online can come too. And then the following week, and on June the 21st, Sunday in the late afternoon, right here at the church, we're going to have a Shukei Tokudo ceremony ordaining 5 new everyday Zen priests. And that is going to be a very joyful occasion. And the very next day, on Monday, June 22nd, there will be some kind of Zen happening, which has been designed by Shufi. We all know Shufi, right? She designed a very clever, complex, and intricate Zen happening poetry event at Cleo's Books in Oakland the day after the ordination. So mark your calendars. Please come to both those events if you can. As if that weren't enough. one of our everyday Zen priests, who many of you probably don't know, but she's a wonderful person, a great Zen priest, Ruth Ozeki. She's also a world-famous novelist and fiction writer, and she's around doing events for her brand new book of stories. I actually think she's reading tonight in Santa Cruz, and I think that Pearl and Maya are going to go to her reading tonight. She's then going to go to Los Angeles and New York, so those of you who are around Los Angeles and New York, maybe Ruth Ozeki has a website, O-Z-E-K-I, so you can look at her schedule on the website. She might be coming to a place near you. And finally, the last thing, which is maybe the best of all, is Sangha Week at Tassajara with Jean. After the Zendo burned down at Tassajara, don't we all want to go down there and support them and see what's going on down there after the Zendo burning? July 7th through 12th. So please sign up and go down if you can. Okay, I wanted to let you know about all that stuff. Now we'll do our groups of three.
Recording stopped.
And I think everybody knows how to do this, so sometimes I repeat the instructions, but I won't tonight because I think everybody here knows. Groups of three, about, I think we have 4 minutes, each person, 4 minutes. Four, 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 three monologues without interruption, and then 4 more minutes for whatever else needs to be said. So I'll see you again in about 20 minutes. And if you are inclined to talk about this, I think it would be really good to talk about the relationship between Zazen and your practice of human relationship. How does Zazen, if it does, influence the way you are with people? Maybe you can see, you know, some change over time, or you have seen some change over time. Or maybe it's something you're just thinking about for the first time and want to explore in the group. So that's the topic for the groups. And Jane is our Zoom host. She'll put everything